Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
And me, Ben Hobson.
Today we're speaking with Chris McDougall about Born to Run 2. The follow-up.
Is it actually the follow-up? Have you, or is that you artistic license from you there?
No, that's not the title. It's got an extended title. Okay, but Born to Run 2 is the kind of the headline. And we were talking about this, weren't we? Kind of anyone who's not familiar with Born to Run, a very, very quick synopsis on that book. Came out in 2009 and it's credited as starting the boom in barefoot running. And it told the tale of the Tarahumara who live in the Copper Canyons of Mexico and run for hundreds of miles in sandals, seemingly without getting injured. And McDougall essentially kind of looked at why this might be and came to various conclusions about the benefits of going back to sort of natural running, maybe kicking off your shoes, eating more naturally and all that stuff. And it was a massive bestseller, but probably one of the biggest and most influential running books of all time, I'd say. So this follow-up, let's get excited.
Yeah, I think so. I think the impact of the book was, even if you've not read it, the impact of the book will, you'll still be, your parts of your running life will be influenced by it, perhaps.
Definitely.
Or something like that. And also, what's interesting is that when we spoke to Mr. McDougall, was that we asked him about the whole barefoot thing.
Mm.
And he was quite clear in the sort of, it was quite a small part of the book. It was the bit that everyone seemed to latch on to, but there was actually only one guy in it who was like Mr. Hardcore Barefoot, and everyone else was still wearing shoes. But everyone
because it's often like it almost became a bit of a victim of its own success, that book thing.
Yeah,
and it was, and like you say, it was maybe misinterpreted by some people going out and buying like Vibram Five Fingers.
Yep.
Hello, myself included.
Hello, guilty.
And then sort of going running on really hard surfaces, and then kind of looking at the book in anger when you kind of had a suspected stress fracture. So in some ways, it's had like thinking this. It's become very easy to slag off, I think, Born to Run. Very easy for people to say, oh, you know, like Born to Run just said, you know.
It's also like it was a book of its era, wasn't it? Or certainly it started an era of running that it was kind of held responsible for.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? So, retrospective looking back at it, everyone would be like, oh, haven't times changed or something? But actually, the fundamentals of the book and what he's talking about and the way he touches upon nutrition and in the new book too, again, he goes into nutrition and diet and running and as a whole. It's much more of a guide, the second one. So
yeah, that's it. Yeah, I think it's more sort of training manual. And he's teamed up with Eric Orton, who is kind of the named coach in Born to Run. So he's kind of bringing the coaching now, and I think that McDougall's great storytelling plays a part in kind of bringing to life some of these great runners and how they're using that kind of running to achieve brilliant things. So it was great to talk to him, wasn't it?
I really can. I mean, he was up at 5:30 in the morning to talk to us. So
I live in Hawaii, isn't he?
I don't know about you, Rick, but if I try and have a conversation 6:30 in the morning, it's not a lucid or interesting one. And we got both, so that was
fair play to him. Yeah, probably the earliest anyone's gotten up to speak with us, isn't it? 6:30.
I think him and Alex Hutchinson once, when he was on to talk to us,
both
early starts for those guys. Two great pillars of the running community. So there we go.
Well, I think without further ado, we should get on our early rising author, Chris McDougall, to talk about Born to Run 2.
Guest of the week, here in the studio, guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone, could be an athlete, could be a physio, or a complete unknown.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for making time to speak with Runner's World UK. I was saying to Ben beforehand that Born to Run was such an influential book for me. I actually don't think I would be talking to you as someone who works at Runner's World without reading that book. So it's lovely to talk to you after, well, it's probably about 10 years ago that I read that book. So there you go.
You know, it's funny. I'll sometimes talk to people and some kid will say, you know what? I read your thing in this book in middle school. I'm like, yeah. Now he's like a grown ass adult. Like, dude, don't age me like that.
Born to Run has to be, you know, one of the biggest sort of phenomenons in running literature. I struggle to think of a book that had a bigger impact, certainly the last sort of 30 years. Was it intimidating to try to kind of to put yourself in the Born to Run world again after it and do this Born to Run too? Were you kind of, was there something like almost like the kind of difficult second album that you might experience?
Not really, because it was nothing I really considered. I wasn't planning ever to do a Born to Run 2. To me, that was a one-off adventure, and I felt like the curtain dropped at just the right point. And so I never intended to circle back at all. And the only reason I did is because, well, basically there were two reasons. One was I'd actually set out to write a different book. I was contracted to write a book called King of the Weekend Warriors. And I was writing it because I was kind of disturbed by the, you know, no pain, no gain, you know, run yourself into the hospital mentality that has been spreading through running. You know, I call it sort of the David Goggins effect. You got to just like destroy your kidneys or else you haven't really tried your hardest.
Yeah.
And looking at this thinking, this is like completely the wrong message to associate running. That so much of running, unfortunately, is associated with pain. You know, if you're not uncomfortable, you're not doing it right. And so I started to write this book called King of the Weekend Warriors, where I focused on people that I know that are very high performing, very skilled athletes, but who go about it with a sense of complete joy and fun and camaraderie. But then after about 2 years of working that book, something started to bother me, and I realized that I wasn't writing it because I wanted to tell a story. I was writing it because I wanted to win an argument. That All I was really trying to do was tell David Goggins, dude, you're wrong. And it seems like such a sour way to present a book. And I felt it infecting the book that I was writing. So I hit pause on that and thought, okay, what's the opposite? What's the opposite kind of book you can write that is really about sharing something that you truly believe and people really want to know? And that's when it dawned on me that I've been getting requests for advice ever since Born to Run came out. You know, I've gotten, I would say, in the hundreds of thousands of requests from people asking me for advice. And I never give it because, like, I'm not that guy. You know, I'm not a coach. I'm not a physiologist. I don't know how to fix your injuries. And then it finally got through my head, well, like, I know those guys. Like, I know those people. So why not write a book that actually taps into that kind of knowledge?
So how would you go about describing Born to Run 2 then? Is it part training guide, part stories, part something? How because it's sort of the concept of it is a merging of different ways of sort of talking about running. How do you best describe it?
I look at it as everything that wasn't in Born to Run 1 is in Born to Run 2. Right. And basically it. But there are two things that I felt constricted by in Born to Run. Number one was there are all these great stories and dramas in our sport, but you can only include so many. And even though I am like super hyperactive and ADHD, like off the chart, even my attention span, I could not fit all those kind of distractions into Born to Run. So one thing I wanted to do was include stories that I thought were great, but I couldn't tell in the first book. And the second part is I was a very tentative runner at the time that I researched and wrote Born to Run. I was new to the sport myself. I really wasn't positive that any of this stuff worked. You know, I feel like when I talk about minimalist running or my own eating at Born to Run, I'm like, okay, look, I think this stuff works. Let's see. And then it hit me like, hey, 15 years later, it's working. So that's basically it. It is the training advice that I have now realized after 15 years genuinely works.
Do you think, Chris, that any of the messages in Born to Run have been misunderstood or misrepresented? And is part of Born to Run 2 about a chance to sort of address some of these?
That's an interesting question. Are they being misunderstood? Yeah, in one sense, I think, and it's a failing that I have as well, which is that we are a creature of shortcuts. We want to get to the finish line. And, you know, I'm guilty of it as well. You know, when you go on a run, if it is a 10K run, that's 10Ks. You know, it's not, you know, one, it's not a starting line, finish line. It's 10 kilometers. And, but how often do we actually embrace the 10 kilometers? After about three, we're like, all right, you know what? I'm ready for breakfast. Like, let's get this shit over with. And so that's how our mind works. I think our mind and instinct is, all right, what's the shortcut? How can we get this over with? So I think what happened with Born to Run is one of the big surprises to me was when people suddenly started to buy Vibram Five Fingers like crazy. And I was like, oh, that's kind of surprising because the only person in the book who wears Vibram Five Fingers is Barefoot Ted. And he's like the wackiest dude in the book. Like, huh, interesting that of all the advice that anybody could take from Born to Run, they zeroed in on Barefoot Ted. So I think the one thing that maybe was interpreted differently than I would have expected is the sense that you can like buy a product and that's going to solve everything. Or you can just take your shoes off and that's going to solve everything. Because in the book, I don't run barefoot at all. Eric Gorton specifically tells me, look, you can either train for a 50-mile race or you can radically transform your running form. You can't do both. And so we agree on this idea. Like, okay, we will go to a more neutral shoe, a more moderate shoe, because I'm ramping up from 0 to 50 miles in 10 months. So that's the one thing. I think a lot of people thought, oh, I got the answer. You know, I'll buy the Vibram Five Fingers and I'm good.
I did that, you know.
Yeah, Rick, I was going to say, Rick, funny. Straight away.
just describing me. And then I went out and ran like 10K on the road in them and was like kind of surprised that my right foot hurt for a couple of weeks. But I take the point. You're right. Of all the people in the book, you know, Ted's not cast as the sort of responsible trainer. He's like, you know, he's a card, isn't he? But there you go. Go show you. We all make these mistakes, Ben. Well, actually, just me and maybe, but there you go.
Maybe just you, Rick. You mentioned Eric then. How did working with Eric in terms of putting this together come about? And he's obviously a long-term collaborator of yours anyway. So what made you bring him in for this book specifically?
You know, it's funny. I only see Eric physically about once every like 8 years. And yet it's kind of weird. But when we get together, it clicks instantly. And we get along super well. So the idea I had was I wanted the book to cover all the aspects that he and I have been discussing for years. Our belief is that, unfortunately, we've reduced running to just like an interruption in our lives. You know, it's that 45 minutes that we carve out 5 days a week, period. And then we go about the rest of our lives. And we have this belief that ancestrally, evolutionarily, running was completely woven in with all aspects of our lives. And it's a tall order to suggest to people that we do the same thing now because we have lots of other things going on. But our belief is that there are these sort of seven ancestral sources of energy that we can all tap into to make our running feel better, to enjoy it more, to get better at it. So I called them up to say, hey, let's do this book and look at all of what we call the free seven. And we've been having a conversation with the free seven for 15 years now. And as we started talking, that initial phone call, 45 minutes, we sketched out the entire book. So I'd only called him to say, hey, you know, maybe you and I can work on the form and fitness section and we'll find someone else for footwear and someone else for food. But he and I realized we'd already accumulated such an archive of information that in one 45-minute phone call, we had the outline of the book all sketched out.
Would you say, Chris, I guess like I was definitely someone who read the book, probably slightly misinterpreted some of it and was very into sort of barefoot minimalist running. I think since then, my attitude to footwear has probably mellowed a little bit. I still like some of the minimalist philosophy, but I think there's I find from a kind of pragmatic, practical sense, shoes with a little more cushioning work for me. I'd be interested to know if your opinion on footwear has changed at all over the last, say, 15 years, or are you still at heart a kind of minimalist man?
You know, it's funny. I think I'm more radical and extreme by far than even Eric is.
Right.
And I think the reason why is because, so I had an interesting experience actually in the UK. After we had done the Copper Canyon race, and I'd only decided that this could be a book after the race. I hadn't gone into the race thinking that I was going to write a book about it. It was only after I had spent this year training for this race and then went down to the canyon and had it. And as Eric and I were on this like ramshackle journey to try to get back out of the Copper Canyon.
Yeah.
At one point, we're on this bus at like 4 o'clock in the morning, somewhere outside of Chihuahua. And he and I were talking and I was like, hey, you know what? This could be a really good book. Like that was the moment that it dawned on me. But since then, so then after that, I spent 2 years working on the book. And I was actually in the UK for a conference on fascia, on like internal ligaments and tendons. And while I was there, I started to get a heel pain. And I was there for about 2 weeks and my heels really bothered me. I'm like, man, this feels like plantar fasciitis. But that's impossible because I'm a minimalist runner and like my form is now perfect. And so the theory is I should not have plantar fasciitis. Like, what's going on? And a friend of mine who is a parkour guy suggested I talk to Lee Saxby. Have you guys encountered Lee?
Yeah, we know Lee a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so, hey, and this time he was an unknown guy and he was doing fitness training and boxing training in a little gym in the basement of a small hotel. And my friend said, hey, you should go over and talk to this guy, Lee Saxby. So he was literally an underground footwear expert, literally in a gym underground. So I go to see this guy show up unannounced at this little gym and he's like working out with some people he's training. And I explain why I'm there. And I said, but you know, the reason why I wear these minimalist shoes is because I'm a minimalist runner. And he looks at my shoes. He goes, those look like sofa cushions. Those aren't minimalist. I think I was wearing like Nike Pegasus. And he goes, that's the beginning of your problem right there, man. Take those shoes off. Took the shoes off. He ran me through some exercises. He had me run barefoot outside. And then he goes, okay, now, you know, run back to your hotel. I think I was like up at Hyde Park and I think it was about a 3 kilometer run back to my hotel. And he goes, now just throw those shoes in the rubbish and run back to your hotel. And I'm like, really? I'm going to run through downtown London barefoot? And he's like, I would if I were you. And I did. I took his advice and I did it. And anyway, the pain went away. But it was such a like lightning bolt moment for me. For two reasons. Number one was that I was so capable of backsliding. What had happened was, you know, the Pegasus back then was probably only had about a 6 millimeter drop. It was not a radically cushioned shoe back in the day, 20 years ago, 15 years ago. But it was enough cushion for my form to degenerate and for me not to notice. And so over time, I was getting, you know, I was starting to overstride and heel stride and heel strike, and I didn't realize it. And the second thing was that changing behavior could change the outcome so dramatically. So those two things happened. One was, if I wear cushioning, I will backslide. And number two is, if I can change the behavior, I can cure the outcome very, very quickly. And for that reason, I become like a reformed drinker. Like I can't even taste alcohol or I'm going to just, you know, go to pot. For me, like I can't feel cushioning or my form will fall to crap. Eric, he runs in the Teton Mountains. He likes a little bit more cushion underfoot. In the book, we finally recommend a pair of shoes and we recommend Ultras, the Ultra Escalante.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which to me is way too much shoe, but Eric feels is a great transitional shoe.
Yeah, for sure. No, they're good.
That's kind of a zero drop, isn't it? Zero drop, lots of room in the forefoot. So kind of barefoot philosophy, but with cushioning underfoot. So yeah, exactly. I thought you might say Ultra.
How do you feel about the maximal trends then, Christopher? What do you think about this? The size of the shoes these days, particularly now with carbon plates being involved.
So I think the thing about it is, well, one thing is we have to understand. You know, footwear is a sensual pleasure. It's putting a different pair of shoes on your feet is like having a different meal for lunch or dinner. We don't want to eat oatmeal 3 times a day every day. We want to experience something different. So I totally get it. Like I have way more shoes I need and a much broader variety of shoes than I need because it feels good. You know, if I put on like a zero shoe sandal and then the next day I put on the New Balance Minimus, that transition, that new sensation feels good. You enjoy it. It makes your run more enjoyable. So I totally get the pleasure of a nice feeling shoe. However, that said, to me, this constant bombardment of new stuff takes away from what the real message is, which is the craft, the skill of running. You know, if you go to a martial art gym, they're not loading you up with carbon fiber and cushioning and stuff. You walk into a martial arts gym, it's very minimal, it's very bare. You walk into a ballet studio, very minimal, very bare. The idea is start with nothing, master your body's performance, and only add implements as necessary.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You know, we're increasingly talking about things like overconsumption and the idea that running shoes take, you know, hundreds of years to decay on landfill and that sort of stuff. And I think Born to Run was very, very good early on at kind of suggesting the limitations of gear, and actually that the answer may lie somewhere other than getting a new pair of shoes or a new pair of shorts and that kind of thing. So I think that message to come out again, I think, is actually really timely and good. Quick question on diet, Chris. You obviously mentioned in Born to Run the kind of surprising diet of the Tarahumara Indians, and it often, you know, it wouldn't necessarily strike people as the most healthy diet. There were things like chia seeds were talked about. Where are you now in terms of nutrition? What's the kind of nutritional approach recommended in this new book?
So the real revelation for me in that regard was the second book I wrote after Born to Run was Natural Born Heroes. And it presented kind of a dichotomy for me, because in Born to Run, I was down with the Tarahumara, who are by necessity largely vegetarian. They live on a diet of mostly homegrown foods, you know, squash and corn, and little beyond that. And Scott York, who was one of the major influences, he was actually the first ultra runner I ever met, was Scott York. And he has a very disciplined vegan diet. So for Born to Run, I was like, okay, this seems to work. People who eat real foods, mostly vegetables, tend to do very well. So that was my orientation for Born to Run. But then I became aware of this phenomenon of these resistance fighters during World War II who are pulling off these extraordinary physical feats on the Greek island of Crete. So I went over to Crete to check out, well, what do these guys eat? So during World War II, these guys are living 60 miles up in the mountains. They are basically running 60 miles down to the coast, fighting a bunch of Nazis, stealing their weapons, and hucking 60 miles back in the mountains. These guys do a 120-mile ultramarathon with a little bit of mixed martial arts in the middle. Well, what are these guys fueling themselves on? And their diet is radically different. Theirs was actually largely meat-based. So I was trying to figure out, well, what's the connection between these two things? And what essentially it comes down to is the glycemic index. It's basically what foods are jacking up your insulin rates, what foods have that fast burn. And so where we land in both Natural Born Heroes and in Born to Run 2 is a very simple feeling-based orientation for diet. There's a thing called the two-week test. And what you do with the two-week test is, for 14 days, you eliminate all the high glycemic foods from your eating. So you get rid of the pasta, the rice, the breads, you know, the any kind of sugars, fruits, anything which will be a fast burn food. You don't eat any of those for 2 weeks. But you do eat lots of things like tomatoes and sour cream and salmon and meat, if you like meat, or tofu if you don't, all the low burn foods. You do that for 2 weeks. At the end of 2 weeks, you gradually reintroduce some of the high glycemic foods to your diet. So after 2 weeks of no rice, have a little bit of rice, wait an hour, see how you feel. If you feel fine, good. Your body can tolerate a half a cup of rice. Then try a full cup of rice, see how you feel. If you feel sluggish, bloated, that's your limit. And so essentially what we're trying to do with Born to Run 2 is make everything very feeling-based, so you can tell by your own body's reaction how you react to footwear and food as well.
How much trial and error, Chris, did you go through with all of this sort of stuff? I mean, it sounds like that sort of going off into Crete and sampling what those guys were eating and then looking at alternative diets. Like, how much, I mean, it's, how often, how long were you spending just working through different diets and thought processes and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, it was basically two years per project. So Born to Run took 2 years. Natural Born Heroes is 2 years. That seems to be kind of my life cycle. I'll get curious about something, and I'll start to research it, and I'll read a ton and ask some questions and interview people. Then I'll try to immerse myself in the experience. And that whole process takes about a full year. And then I'll spend a year trying to sort it out and write it. But what's interesting is that all of the things that I've become interested in, like footwear or diet or running form, these are things that have really long, deep roots, you know, have great long ancestral pedigree. So like footwear, the shoes that Barefoot Ted recommends, which I also feel are great shoes, those very basic sandals, there's a, you know, 10,000-year resume for those shoes. You know, the Roman centurions wore them, Greek warriors wore them, Jesus wore them, the Thought Romana wear them, and then minimalist runners today wear them. So, you know, and same with the eating plan we suggest in Born to Run 2. It's basically the Mediterranean diet. This is a healthy eating system that has been pursued by the healthiest people in the world for thousands of years.
With Eric Orton, because I got a hold of his book, The Cool Impossible, which I think came out just a bit after Born to Run, and he was very big on foot strength, which you talk about in Born to Run the first time around a little bit, I think. Does that play a role here? Because I think, again, when it comes to strength and conditioning, there's probably things that foot strength might be something that sets Eric apart from some other sort of PTs out there, because it's perhaps something that people undervalue, and yet running is, you know, a bit of a foot game ultimately, or at least on some level. So does that play a part in this book as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because I think the reason why Eric and I work so well together is because he is so knowledgeable and so disciplined as an athlete himself. And I am so like limited attention span, and I'll basically push back. So he'll say, these 15 exercises are crucial for foot strength. I'm like, dude, I am never doing 15 freaking exercises. It's never going to happen. You better boil it down to maybe three. And he's like, well, it shouldn't take more than 45 minutes. Dude, I'm never spending 45 minutes. It's not going to happen. And so between us, that push and pull, I think most times, you know, if your coach tells you to do something, you either do it or you secretly pretend you're going to do it, but you really don't. Eric and I have enough of a rapport where he can say it, and I just call bullshit instantly. Like, no, I'm never going to do it, dude. Give me something else. But I agree with him. I know he's right. But I also know myself that I'm just not going to do something. If it's unpleasant, after 2 weeks, I'll never do it again. And so what it came down to is, yeah, foot strength, what he calls the foot core, is crucial. But what he came up with were these exercises. Here's a simple one. In the morning, you're heating up coffee. You're standing next to a counter. All you got to do is balance on one foot. Get up on the forefoot of one foot, let the other foot hang loose, and just try to balance yourself for a minute or two on each foot while you're waiting for the coffee to warm up. You know, you can do it in a couple, you know, less than 5 minutes. It will activate every muscle, not only in your foot, but up your chain as you're fighting for balance. And that's a great way to reawaken the system, before you even had a sip of coffee.
Yeah, that's great. I love all that stuff. I think, yeah, exercise you can fit into your daily life that don't kind of, that aren't a time drag. That's the kind of stuff we like to try to recommend in the magazine as well, because I think it just acknowledges that people are busy, and it, you know, sometimes the perfect way of doing something just puts people off because it's intimidatingly long or involved.
Yeah. I brushing your teeth and doing calf raises, that was always my, like, once you stood there brushing your teeth, you know, there's a bit of movement going on. Maybe if you're brushing really hard, try and balance while you're doing that.
Yeah.
I really like what you said at the beginning, actually, about removing the sense of pain from running, and the sort of the modern language that's used with running, and the way that it's sort of laid out as a great challenge to the point of destruction. How did you wanted to address that with the book? Did you want to make this as a training guide, but still maintained an essence of running being something that we ancestrally have done, or that is fun and can be enjoyed? Is that sort of something that you really wanted to sort of get across?
Yeah, there are two things, you know, that unfortunately we've adopted as running. One is being solitary, and one as accepting pain as the price of admission. And when you look back ancestrally, this was never a part of how runners or how humans ran, for two reasons. Number one, you would never go off in the wilderness by yourself. That would never happen. If you did, you didn't come back. You know, if you went off running off by yourself, you were something else's food. So ancestrally, we always ran as a group. Secondly, you would never drain your energy tank unless absolutely necessary, because, you know, our legs were the only thing we could rely on for survival. So if you went out and you ran your hardest for an hour, and then trouble arose, and you were blanked out on energy, that was it. You were done. So ancestrally, the way we ran was in a group and always kind of within our aerobic threshold. You know, we kept our heart rates low, we kept our effort moderate, and we ran communally. Unfortunately, that's kind of gone. You know, so you see the success of Park Run, you know, how that took off. Once we reintroduce the aspect of showing up with a group with a smile on your face, people loved it and instantly took to it. We're seeing a lot in the U.S. right now, too, where affinity groups are springing up, where running is based around neighborhood and community, and they're just mushrooming really quickly. What we try to recommend to people is embrace the comfort and the fun of running, and secondly, anything you can do to go with another living creature, be it a person or a dog, you will feel that benefit almost instinctively. It will benefit your running.
Who would you say, Chris, that this book is for? Is it for a particular type of runner? Is it for all runners? Is it more beginner friendly? Is it more elite? Is it ultra runners, short distance? What do you think?
Yeah, that's what, you know, we were aiming the dart right in the center, right in the Venn diagram for everybody. And what we've realized, so this is a really instructive moment for us. It was by accident. So when Eric and I started discussing this, it was back in September of a year ago, and we realized, if we're actually going to do this book and have it out by Christmas, we only have about 7 months to write it. And we were dedicated to having lots of really cool pictures. Like we really wanted to show the diversity of running that a lot of times is not visible in the running world. You know, you see images of running, it tells you a lot of blonde people with ponytails. And what we wanted to show was running is so much more than that. Lots of different people, lots of different body types. So we wanted to illustrate that with photographs in the book. So we thought, you know what? We have a very short runway. Let's do the photos first and then worry about the text later. So we got a bunch of people together in California for this photo shoot. And a lot of them, the majority of them, are very accomplished runners. And when we were putting them through some exercises just for the purposes of illustration for the book, we realized they were actually struggling to do these exercises. So, you know, Jenna Crawford, who has like won half marathons, she's got like a 1 hour and 16 minute half marathon PR, something crazy fast like that. But her glutes are completely deactivated. We would do glute exercises with her and she couldn't accomplish them. And what we realized is no matter what any runner's success is, they are usually deficient in something else. Either they're getting by on the strength of their quads, or their diet isn't really dialed in. Essentially, every runner out there has got a potential catastrophe waiting to happen if they don't sort of look at their whole universal approach. So what we were aiming for was to thread this needle where we can do a reboot for every kind of runner. So if you're a beginner just starting out, this is perfect. If you're a veteran who's got kind of a nagging Achilles pain you haven't figured out, this is perfect. Or if you just kind of plateaued, you're not getting faster, you're not getting longer, you're just kind of muddling along in the middle. The whole idea is this can bring you back to a factory preset, and then you can build up from there.
Chris, thanks so much for coming on the Runner's World podcast. A real privilege and honor to talk to you about Born to Run 2, and I hope it has the great positive impact that the first Born to Run had on lots of people, including me. So thanks very much for your time. I know it's very early for you in Hawaii, so we really appreciate you waking up to speak with us.
Hey guys, thanks very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks a lot,
have a good
Chris.
Day. Thank you. So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. Thanks very much to our guest, Chris McDougall, and to you, of course, for listening.
You can subscribe to 3 issues of Runner's World for just £5. Head to hearstmagazines.co.uk/Runner's World Podcast to get this exclusive listener offer. You listen to the Runner's World podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, all the favourite apps, the Googles. Just search Runner's World UK. Please do subscribe. That's the best thing you can do. Let us know if you're enjoying it. If you're not enjoying it, don't say anything. Thanks for listening, and you will hear from us again next week.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.